Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 428.GN3907, certificate number 2793. Etchings.
Why don't you come up sometime, see me?
As we've mentioned, we're newly home from the cruise where we were not quarantined.
That's right, the Joko cruise.
No one got sick on the nerd boat.
It was kind of amazing. When we were the last cruise to depart, and really, when we got back to port, they shut down all cruises.
As I was leaving the ship, the captain got on the PA to cancel shore leave in his Dutch accent.
Yeah, for all of the crew. Like,
because they were not, there is no shore leave. The cruising is over forever.
Yeah, that's right. We're not switching it over. We're not bringing 10,000 more eggs on the ship. It's done. We're closing it down.
So now we're back. Instead of being quarantined on a boat, we're quarantined in Seattle, which is nice. Seattle's nicer than a boat.
We're in our homes, so that makes it easier.
Our children are here.
Our children, where Seattle, they play with their toys.
Seattle has other advantages over a cruise ship, although I can't think of any right now.
Well, although we are sequestered and everything's shut down, there are stores, and they're still open, and you can go get Hershey bars.
There were stores on the boat.
Well, yeah, but you had to pay, you were complaining about $4 Coke Zeros.
There was no, what I thought was the drugstore pretty much sold Jonathan Colton Cruise performer merch and Holland America merch.
Right.
And it did not really have the stuff I thought you would want on a cruise, like eye drops or Q-tips.
One time I was on a cruise and I went to that little store and said, do you have any razors? It seems like a razor. I would like a razor. I'd like to shave. And they said, normally we do, but we don't have any now. I was like, really? How did it not make it onto the palette? It seems like you would...
You got 10,000 eggs, but you don't have...
Well, there's a limited number of things for sale in this store, and razors are not a rationed thing. They're not a thing that you have a hard time finding.
That would be your top five items.
Right.
If it's just the things that you would call down to a hotel desk because you forgot them.
Toothbrush, toenail clippers, soap, razors.
Top five.
Right.
What did you... We were talking on the cruise about how you consume no media of any kind.
On the cruise, right.
Well, in general. In
your life. Oh, that's also true.
Did you bring a book even on the cruise?
Typically on the cruise, what I do for entertainment is sit on my little balcony and stare at the ocean and look for UFOs. I feel like in the middle of the night when everyone else is asleep.
You go walking. How does it go? In the middle of the. I go walking in the.
With my.
It's my Billy Joel song.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. No, I go out.
You're not a fan of anything. What if Billy Joel were the one thing you were a fan of? Now all these nerds wearing their Starfleet uniforms. Bonos.
But then they're like, Piano Man. No. No, I'm a fan of UFOs coming up out of the sea. And so I sit on the deck in the middle of the night.
In the hopes that.
Wearing my white gown. I walk out on the fens in my white gown.
People think you're a ghost often on the ship.
They do.
It's a common occurrence.
But I'm mourning the man in black who died rather than betray our affair.
Johnny Cash?
Yeah, that's right.
That's amazing that you two had a liaison.
Well, he's dead now, so I can finally reveal it. Just like
sorry,
I
June, but...
Just like I revealed that Thomas Guinness was behind the leasing of my famous ship. The Cousteau.
The YMS Calypso.
So no, I don't bring a book. I just search the sea for UFOs and so far unsuccessful in 11 cruises.
I cannot fathom a world in which I would get on a plane, much less an 8-day cruise, without something to read.
Without a book, right. But you are someone, and this cruise really revealed it, who needs action. You want something to be happening. And I don't mean needs action like you're a war correspondent addicted to adrenaline.
I don't need a speedboat chase.
You just need some task or duty or something to something that you feel like is a legitimate use of your time.
A couple times on the cruise, we had two straight days at sea because the itinerary got a little messed up.
Yeah.
And followed by a shore day. And those, it turned out 2 days on that boat.
Is your stir crazy limit?
A bit much. I was a little restless.
I kept thinking up missions for you. You know, like, Ken, I want you to
go buy me a drink.
Yeah, Ken, I want you to go around the boat and find every chocolate milkshake and bring them to me immediately. Find every chocolate dipped strawberry. And you were like, that's not enough of a mission.
I actually was just trying to invent stuff to do. Do people's podcasts, try to find,
right,
you know, something.
There's an unlimited number of sea monkeys that would recruit you into their lockpicking class if you'd made that widely known that you were bored.
I did not do the lockpicking class, but maybe I should have. Maybe I could have got off the boat.
You could have gotten into my house without ringing the doorbell so obnoxiously.
But I knew I was going to need a lot of reading, and I had a collection of Library of America collection of Raymond Chandler detective novels, mm-hmm, that I had not started yet. And so it has like
his, can confirm,
it has the four last Philip Marlowe detective novels from The Little Sister on, I guess.
You sat around the swimming pool singing their praises as though I'd never heard of Raymond Chandler.
No, you had never read Raymond Chandler. You'd seen like the Humphrey Bogart movie.
Not like I'd never read any of it.
Giving you a little review.
You were.
Because I enjoy them very much. They're really very densely plotted, overplotted. He would often combine two different short stories he had written. He would cannibalize them into one novel and kind of try to get the plot threads.
But famously accurate dialogue written in vernacular.
Yeah, written in, it's a little bit heightened. Like, I think Dashiell Hammett was the one who was an actual Pinkerton and kind of knew how you would follow a perp, how you would put a tail on someone, mm-hmm, you know, how you would know if somebody'd been in your hotel room. You know, he knew all the tricks of the trade. Marlowe's a little more literary, or Chandler's a little more literary, and so Marlowe talks in a bit of it's slang, but it's very heightened.
Yeah.
And in at least two of the novels, he makes a joke about, I guess, the common 1930s euphemism of coming up to look at someone's etchings.
Come on up and look at my etchings.
You have heard this before.
Yeah.
What do you gather from it?
It just seems like a pickup line.
Yeah.
Like come up to my artist's garret and look at my etchings. Let's go down and watch the submarine races.
Is that what you say?
That's what I say.
That one seems a little more sexual because it's down instead of up.
Yeah, let's go out to the point and watch the submarine races. It takes a second.
Is Makeout Point where you wind up?
Something? Yeah, you wind up at Makeout Point, and she's like, "Wait a minute, submarine races!" I'm like, yeah, they're out there.
But it's you're not dating the brightest bulbs, so they
no, but they're so smart that they're like, submarine races, that seems like it would be an interesting adventure.
Or they immediately see through your charade and they see the proposition for what it is.
And they're like,
but they go anyway.
I gleefully accept and I will play along. That's how it actually happens.
How do you take this? Do you think there are actual etchings?
Yes. It's a way of revealing that you are a frustrated artist, which in and of itself is a kind of romantic enticement. Like, did you know that I'm also very creative?
I have an artistic temperament.
Yeah,
it could also be a sign of wealth. Like if I have a nice collection of etchings.
Oh, other artists' etchings.
Oh, you think it might be your own work?
Well, that's what I always thought. Ah. Come up and look at my etchings that I've done of you know, like these poorly thought out etchings of church steeples and little boys.
There is some of that in the history of the phrase. I was kind of looking into, by the time Marlowe uses this cliche, this kind of cliched pickup line or proposition, it seems a bit shopworn, kind of like everything about him.
Uh-huh.
Like he's commenting ironically on the trope of inviting a woman to, like, he'll often say, oh, do you want me to come up and see your etchings? You know,
it does
some
feel
withering
little,
put down for the femme fatale throwing herself at him.
It's a little jazz age sounding for someone that's in the noir years.
And it kind of seems like by the time it catches on, it's already a punchline. Like, I feel like I've heard it much more sardonically than I ever have seen it, like, in some sincere Mae West, come up and see me sometime kind of a way.
Right.
Like, it immediately became a hack way to hit on a lady or gentleman.
I can't imagine it was ever a sincere. I mean, only one person could have ever said it sincerely, and the person standing nearby that overheard it immediately said it ironically.
How would it catch on, though? Like, it's very oddly specific. Of all the, you know, because we have expressions like, you know, let's come up for a nightcap.
Right.
You know, we already have euphemistic ways to say, well, we could go to your place.
Right.
Right? Etchings is very specific. Do you own any etchings?
Do I own any
etchings? I know
all etchings.
Your possessions are right now in a big cube, a big Borg cube somewhere.
In fact, I do. My friend Ben Barris of the arts collective Sutton Barris Color, a local Seattle sort of agitprop.
Consortium?
Arts consortium. He has been doing etchings for the last several years. I own an early example of his etchings because he, one time he asked me to play an art opening. And I was like, why would I play your art opening? And he said, I'll give you an etching. And
was he coming on to you?
So he did. He said, come up and see my etchings. He gave it to me. And then when I was dating Millennium Girlfriend, she fell in love with Ben Barris's etchings and bought two or three of them.
She came up to see your etchings.
She came up to see his etchings. Or she saw my etching and then she wanted some of her own. And then I bought another one recently that he claimed he did on mushrooms, which looked completely unlike his other etchings. And the fact that but he's actually included lyrics from my songs in some of his etchings.
Oh, interesting. Do you get a discount on those?
No. But now he's doing glassware. He's actually etching stuff into mugs, and it's beautiful. And I've been thinking about getting some of his newer etchings. So, in fact, I have seduced a woman by saying, come see my etchings.
And you have a very etching-centric life. I had no idea when I asked that question how good your etchings resume was about to be.
I own a few etchings and have used them as a seduction
technique. I have one etching. And I'd already been married for well over 15 years when I bought my etching, and I've never seduced anyone with it.
Or, no, anyone, full stop.
Exactly. My wife and I in our twin beds like to look at the etching, and then we reach over and turn out the light.
My sense of your story of your marriage is just that she decided to marry you because she woke up having had a sort of afternoon, maybe nightmare. Like, oh no, I'm going to marry Ken.
But no, the nightmare is that she's not married to me. And it was so horrific that she immediately had to marry me.
Yeah, I misheard that story, I guess.
Well, she woke up with the story's not wrong. She woke up with the sudden conviction that we were going to be married, despite the fact that we had just got out on our first date. So whatever the mind control drugs were,
right?
I don't know on whose end, but they did work.
But it wasn't really seduction unless your seduction prowess is so strong.
Yeah, exactly.
Like one date.
I have to limit it for that reason. I'm thinking that maybe etchings is not the right medium for if you're on mushrooms, because it's a very laborious and detailed and kind of fiddly little process. Do you know how etchings get etched?
But he is a fiddly and laborious etcher, although not a person that you wouldn't think of him as. In looking at him, you're not like, oh, what a meticulous weirdo.
He doesn't have a green visor thing.
No, he seems like a wild weirdo. So,
but if you have that in you, does psilocybin just make you more fiddly and laborious?
What it did was it made him less. His work is extremely intricate, and this one is much more sort of freehand and looks a little bit crazy. I'm sorry to confess that I was having it framed, and it's at his studio right now. So I need to go pick up that etching. I don't have it here.
We should post a photo of it for the time capsule.
We should. So
I looked into the process of etchings, which I didn't understand the various kinds of printmaking very well. Mm-hmm. Etching is unusual in that it's an intaglio process. Mm-hmm. It is not relief. You know, we're used to kind of potato print style of printmaking where the inked portion is raised.
Right.
The weird thing about etching is that the inked portion is lowered, and you think, Ken, how can that possibly work?
How can that be, Ken? Explain it to us
now. I will explain. You have some kind of metal plate that you cover with wax, and then you carve with some kind of instrument. You scrape out the drawing in the wax, so only the exposed metal is there. And then you use some kind of acid to eat away the exposed line work.
Right.
So now you've got these little trenches all over. And what you can do is you can effectively fill the trenches with ink. And so the ink will be at the surface level of the rest of the plate. And when the paper is pressed, the ink in the trenches, you know, only that line work will survive.
Yeah, they're really fascinating too. And I think that that's evident in them when you look closely at them. They seem made by a different process.
They have a very kind of finely detailed quality. You know, this goes back to, I don't know, the 16th century, you know, German engravers like Albrecht Dürer. Maybe you can imagine some of his etchings, the hands. Rembrandt, much of his prolific output was engravings and etchings. And there was a 19th century revival in etching in around 1860 in France that later spread throughout Europe and the New World and kind of jump-started our story today, and gave us the come up and see my etchings cliche that was everywhere in the culture in the 1930s. In Dashiell Hammett's 1934 novel, The Thin Man, classic detective fiction, Nick and Nora Charles, one character protests that a good looking redhead was only in his apartment because, quote, she just wanted to show me some French etchings.
Mm.
So the French kind of modifies it and makes it a little saucy.
She brought her portfolio of etchings to lay out on his table.
Maybe it's her place, or maybe she did bring them. That's the classic joke of one of the most famous etching references. Often New Yorker cartoons would use this punchline. In the same way today, you'll see the New Yorker try to use memes and stuff.
Right.
There's a famous 1937 cartoon where a caveman invites in a cavewoman to his cave so that
he can see her etchings.
And they're just cave paintings.
Oh, the New Yorker.
And in 1939, the most famous one is a James Thurber panel where an overly fussy gentleman has a woman sitting in the lobby of his apartment and he says essentially, "You wait here, I'll bring my etchings down." He's not very good at
missing
it.
Missing the point entirely.
I remember when etchings were about the printmaking.
Right.
You know?
And she woke up the next morning going, "Oh, I'm going to marry him."
but there were dirty etchings. And I wonder if
we got to the dirty etchings part.
Because they were a small kind of portable format in an era without photography, if you wanted kind of a lusty view of the Greek gods cavorting with mortal women, or even later these etchings became kind of, do you know the concept of...
No, wait a minute. In the 1930s, we had photography.
No, I'm talking about... I'm talking about this prior centuries. I'm talking about from Albrecht Dürer up until the etchings revival of the 19th century. That was a time when pornographic etchings abounded.
Now, did our truly great artists, the Rembrandts and the Dürers, et cetera, were they making porn on the side?
I don't think so.
Are there any Rembrandt porns?
Is that what you want?
I love his... I love his work. I love his pen and ink.
And I love his smoker's toothpaste. Mm. But isn't that right? Isn't Rembrandt like a
smoker's toothpaste? Rembrandt. Am I thinking of Topol?
I always get Rembrandt condoms and Topol confused. Which one's in Fiddler on the Roof?
Topol.
Yeah, probably.
Who also was in the movie I watched last night?
For Your Eyes Only?
No, he appears prominently in Flash Gordon.
Oh yeah, he's in Flash Gordon. I forgot.
He's Zarkov, the scientist. What are the chances that you would make a Topol reference?
Right when you were you were fresh from his oeuvre.
Wow.
He's our favorite Israeli actor here on The Omnibus.
Right.
They were often, I think, in the style of great artists.
Our favorite Israeli actor until Wonder Woman came out recently.
That's right. And then Gal Gadot became our
favorite. Gal Gadot is my new favorite Israeli actor.
Not me. I mean, they're both very good looking, but if I was judging a beauty contest and it was Gal Gadot and Topol, I might have to go Topol.
Which one fiddled on a roof?
He doesn't actually fiddle. He's the milkman. He's the milkman below the roof. What I'm trying to say is that sometimes these pornographic etchings were in the style of great artists, but they were by lesser hands.
They were by...
And maybe by one hand.
By Al Jaffe.
Yeah, exactly. Mad Magazine, by the way, since you mentioned Al Jaffe, would often make jokes about etchings, and a lot of boomers probably grew up knowing the gag about something sexy about etchings from Mad Magazine parodies.
But not connecting it to... Because by the time we got to Mad Magazine, they're making a reference to a reference to a reference.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're referencing 1930s pre-code movies and these detective novels.
Because all their artists were born in 1907.
Exactly. So, and kids grew up looking at this stuff, and it's the classic Simpsons gag about Bart Simpson saying, they're really sticking it to this Spiro Agnew guy. He must work there or something. It's all the stuff that's incomprehensible. But as a child, if you're told that it's comedy, you will say, ha 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 ha.
That seems like a George Meyer joke right there.
I wonder if it is. He loved Mad Magazine. Apparently, some of the dirtier engravings of later days were effectively Tijuana Bibles. Do you know what a Tijuana Bible is?
It's Tijuana Bible?
Do you pronounce it Tijuana, even though no Mexican would?
I do. Right. Do you pronounce it Perry? Do you pronounce it München?
I do say München.
My wife and I were vacationing in Budapest.
Well, I love that the East has kind of started to reclaim, you say Beijing instead of Peking, you say Mumbai instead of Bombay. What if, like, Europe started doing that?
Right.
You know?
It's not...
What if Denmark was like, you have to say Copenhagen now? Nobody has any choice.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Moskva.
Exactly. We can start saying Moskva.
Why don't we start doing that immediately?
We already say Barcelona.
Oh, some
with,
of us.
With the theta.
I guess I do sometimes. Barcelona.
I do it as a bit.
Barcelona.
But these, Tijuana Bibles are, 20th century kind of cheaply made.
You're going to stick with this Tijuana Bible?
You're going to say Tijuana?
Well, yeah, Tijuana. Do you really say Tijuana? No one will know what you're talking about.
Tijuana is the correct pronunciation. Tijuana,
but that's not what you said. You said Tijuana.
I'm dumbing it down for the people.
Tijuana.
But not all the way to Tijuana. I'm not going to add a syllable for you.
Tijuana.
It's not called.
Tijuana. That's where we went. We never went to Tijuana.
Do you want to see a donkey show? No, I don't.
Okay. You say Tijuana. I'll say Tijuana.
Let's call the whole thing off.
Right.
A Tijuana Bible is a early.
I just cannot abide it. Tijuana.
It's an early 20th century kind of cheaply printed publication that shows a popular celebrity or comic strip star in pornographic situations.
Right.
So if your whole life you've fantasized about what Dagwood Bumstead's love life is actually like now you can see it if you get one of these bootleg publications.
Have you ever seen the poster of all the Disney characters but done naked?
Yeah, it's by Wally Wood, I think.
Yeah.
It's some classic Mad Magazine / EC artist.
Right.
Yes, I have.
It scandalized me when I was a kid. I went
you
to
shouldn't
some.
You should be looking at that as a kid.
Well, I used to go to like hippie houses with my older siblings where people were smoking marijuana. And
it's not marijuana.
And this was hanging on the wall of one of those places. And of course, they meant it all stoner ironic because it was also a blacklight poster.
And you're like, I'm going to spend the rest of my life bothering millennials about Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers comics.
I stood there with my toes touching the wall, staring at this, watching Snow White ravished by the
do horrific
seven
things
dwarves.
To the dwarves. Yeah. It's awful. So there were 18th century engravings that would show like Marie Antoinette in all varieties of Congress. So there is a tradition of etchings being a little dirty, and maybe that's why it gets chosen for the joke.
Oh, I see. Come see my classic etchings of Marie Antoinette being ravished by Pope Pius.
That's my theory, because if you were to say it in French, the equivalent French cliche is come up and look at my estampes japonaises. Come look at my Japanese woodblock prints.
Oh,
and
which also
know,
famously are
right,
sexy.
Some of those are pretty and some are sexy, and so there's some ambiguity there. But the idea that you would use an art collection as a pretext for seduction actually goes way further back than the 20th century, than noir. It's a common trope in restoration comedy, in British plays of the 17th century. One of the most famous of which is William Wycherley's The Country Wife. Now, this is a play so dirty that it wasn't published or performed for centuries. The actor David Garrick produced a cleaned-up version called The Country Girl.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is he left in the dirty pun. I mean, The Country Wife is supposed to, you're supposed to hear the first syllable in country and kind of know the kind of naughty goings on that are going to happen. That was a pun back then.
So you clean it up and say the country girl, but
he left in the country.
Right.
And so that was the one
taking the O out of country, if you know what I'm saying.
Exactly. But the cleaned up one was the one that got performed a lot. But in the original, The Country Wife, there's a famous scene in which Horner, the not accidentally named rakish, seductive guy, gets taken off stage by two women who want to look at his china collection. Mm. And there's a lot of offstage comment about the impressiveness of his china collection as they examine it. And in the meantime, you know, two characters are on the stage eavesdropping and kind of oohing and aahing over the misunderstanding.
Thinking it was a euphemism?
Yeah, thinking something naughty is happening offstage. And in that one scene, you can see essentially all of British comedy up through the 20th century is that kind of a setup with, you know, the two Ronnies overhearing some conversation and being like, what did they say?
What?
Because they
would
misunderstand
like
the
parrot?
Reference. And there's a similar conversation in The Man's Bewitched, which is not an episode of Bewitched. It's a restoration comedy by the most famous female playwright of the time, Susanna Centlivre, who has a character say, interrogating, "Nay, then 'tis proper to be alone. There is a very pretty collection of prints in the next room, madam. Will you give me leave to explain them to you?"
Mm. Oh, so it's a mansplaining opportunity.
Exactly. Like, I'm going to come talk to you about my prints. But really, it's an excuse to get women alone. And I guess this was a time when it would have been harder to get a potential partner alone because you have to have a space to say, come up to.
Right, and you have to have some reason other than come up and show me your undergarments.
Right, so there's the prudishness of the culture, but there's often just the unavailability of private space.
Right.
Right, in an era when even kings and queens kind of had to, you know, if you've ever been to any European palace, you'll see how, you know, this is where the queen's bedchamber was, and every day people would file in and help her bathe and change her clothes, and, you know, even
sure. Clean the poop up from behind the curtains.
Yeah, before the 18th century, even the very wealthy did not have much private space to say, come up and see me sometime.
There might not even have been a sense of it, except I suppose if you were the king or queen, you could say, everyone out, except for the prince to whom I'm going to show my etchings.
That's right, if you have enough wealth and power.
But you probably had an etching room.
If you're just on the streets of London, though, you don't have the option of doing that.
Well, and it feels also like something edifying. It feels like you're offering them. Oh, and also,
culture.
If you invite somebody up to your room under a pretense and they believe the pretense is true, you have an out if you have some etchings.
I agree 100%. I think that's why this kind of euphemism survives to, like, you know, because today we still have similar euphemisms. Like a few years ago, Netflix and chill was a famous thing to say that did not mean let's watch Netflix. And the thing about a euphemism like that is it gives you an out if the seduction is unsuccessful.
You're like, well, all I asked was that you come watch Netflix.
We can still watch BoJack Horseman, right?
Right.
Yeah. So you're not putting it quite as much on the line, and you're avoiding the taboo topic of, would you like to come up to my chambers? There is a respectable pretense.
Right. I think these days you would say, do you want to see my salt collection?
Is that what you
would say? Because everyone's collecting salt these days. That's really one of the most popular sort of, I'm talking to the futurelings now. If you look back to the early 2020s, salt collecting is like blowing up.
People with pink Himalayan sea salt
and such 700 different kinds of salt. Black salt, rock salt.
White pistachio nut.
Country salt.
Red pistachio nut.
Jazz salt.
There are a couple of things that happened in the 1890s that started to etch, if you will, this cliche in the popular mind. Horatio Alger, the best-selling author of his time, all these kind of rags-to-riches stories of good American youths pulling themselves up by their bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
In his 1890 book, The Erie Train Boy, he has a woman.
Eerie like Erie Canal or no, eerie
it's,
like
it's
weird?
Not, it's not haunted. It's the train to Erie, PA, I assume, or maybe Erie County, New York. In this case, because the thing about the artistic collections that are used as sexual signifiers, they're never etchings up until this point. You know,
up until the Horatio Alger stories?
Yes.
Oh.
A collection of china is...
It's really the euphemism? Can we bring that back?
That was a very famous scene. So, yeah, people would... like, the word china did kind of become a little bit naughty because people understood its association with this famous scene, even though it's a little bit arbitrary. There's right. If you were trying to choose something that seemed like a good innuendo, you might choose something a little more phallic or with a better pun than a china collection.
Well, yeah, but, you know, your innuendo at that point is meant to be something you can say in front of a matron who's guarding the virtue true, of a maiden.
True. But it could be anything in that case.
Right.
If it can be a china collection, it can also be a credenza or your Hummel.
Although
figurines.
If you say like come see my collection of literature, it could be that's a little too sexy. I mean, china is absolutely unsexy. And so
that's true.
In that sense, maybe ultimately sexy.
But the use of etchings for this trope may begin with Horatio Alger, who has a woman tell a male suitor, apropos, I have a new collection of etchings that I want to show you. Won't you name an evening when you will call?
Oh.
And so it's coming from a woman in this case.
Ooh, and which I'm is getting titillated just hearing it.
Is that what you want?
Yeah, it might be your voice, though.
Apropos, I have a new collection of etchings. And then he falls for it. He says, I shall no doubt find pleasure in examining the etchings, which you hold out as an inducement to call. I mean, and knowing what we now know about how etchings became a cliche, this seems a little bit naughty, but I'm sure nothing could have been further from Horatio Alger's mind. These were fine, upstanding works. These weren't depraved like you're trying to make it with that face.
I feel like the connection to Japanese etchings, and in particular the upskirt shots, would be present even then.
Really, people would know about tentacle etchings?
Well, but we're talking about fin de siècle.
That's true.
Culture, where the arts and crafts movement, and this Japonoise like culture was part of the fashionable set.
Maybe
you're so mad right now.
Well, I'm just
because I said Japonoise.
I'm still more mad about Tijuana, honestly. Maybe people would know. I just think. I naively think of all the good little boys and girls reading Horatio Alger books as not having the cultural avalanche that we have today,
right?
Where our kids know every dirty joke as soon as it appears.
Your fin de siècle was just William Morris prints. You were like, that was the era of the best wallpaper.
This wallpaper is fantastic.
And I'm like, oh man, the access to Japanese porn was blowing up.
The other thing that happened in the 1890s that may have helped cement etchings in particular as a device for this use was the most famous news event of the time. Do you know anything about the murder trial involving Harry Thaw and Stanford White?
Tell me more.
I think it was maybe the first time the phrase the trial of the century was used for a really amazing murder trial that captures everybody's mind.
This was in 1899, so they're like, we know all the trials up till now.
We've seen all the trials, and this is definitely going to be the one of the century.
Right.
They will all, I mean, that's when you should be doing it, right?
Right at the end.
And we did it with OJ in the same way. In the 90s, we were like, we've seen the scopes, we've seen all the 20th century trials.
Sure, Nuremberg.
Court martial. Yeah, Nuremberg was fine.
But OJ.
But check it out. This one has a car chase in it.
You're right. It is a little arrogant to say something is the trial of the century in 1902.
We can't do it today.
Right.
We're still a little too early. You gotta wait. Stanford White was one of the most famous Americans, or the most famous New Yorkers, at least of the time. He was a leading architect.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for McKim, Mead & White, the leading architecture firm. And he had really kind of turned New York from slightly provincial Edith Wharton kind of a town to what we see today with the canyons of skyscrapers and all the kind of Romanesque marble and terracotta facades, just kind of majestic avenues, which was not a thing that New York had before him. You know, he gave us the Washington Square Arch and most famously the original Madison Square Garden was his design.
Mm-hmm.
He had a marriage of long standing to a lovely woman named Bessie that I think he had known when he was young, but she was out in Long Island.
Oh, yeah.
And when the cats were
sequestered.
Away, yeah, she was sequestered on Long Island because she knew that Spanish flu was coming in 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he would spend his time in his little, he had a some kind of garret above Madison Square Garden, because when you design Madison Square Garden, you got to build yourself an apartment.
I love it already.
And he had a studio in the Tenderloin, like on 24th Street, above what was then FAO Schwartz, the original FAO Schwartz toy store.
Man, he was living.
So he had two different places where he could bring chorus girls, and that's exactly what he did. He was always at the Broadway shows, and in the around 1890, he goes to see the famous Floradora girls at that floor show, and falls for a particular Spanish dancer, in quotes, named Evelyn Nesbitt.
Mm, famous Spanish name.
Yeah. She was not super Spanish.
Evelyn Nesbitt.
She was playing a Spanish dancer. And she probably had some kind of Nesbitts. She probably had some kind of peasant blouse. I'm sure it's just an excuse for cleavage.
Listen, I fall for a peasant blouse every time.
You love Oktoberfest.
Even
though you don't drink beer anymore.
Nope.
You will just go drink Coke Zeros at Oktoberfest.
The St. Pauli girl can lead me right out of the brew hall.
And Evelyn Nesbitt at the time, even though she was only 16 years old, was already a bit of a celebrity. She'd been plucked from obscurity as a shop girl just because apparently she just had a beautiful, fresh face, peaches and cream. Charles Dana Gibson, the popular artist of the time.
The Gibson girl drawer.
If you can picture the Gibson girls of the time, one of the most famous ones is a girl in profile whose kind of large, lustrous hair makes a question mark, and it's called the Eternal Question. And that was actually a portrait of Evelyn Nesbitt. So it came out at the later trial that Stanford White would invite chorus girls up to his studio to show them his etchings, yes, his art collection.
Wow.
And
Evelyn Nesbitt looks exactly like my ex-girlfriend, Megan. And I knew she would.
Is that why you looked her up?
Yeah. I knew she would because I just had a sense. The peasant blouse, the heart-shaped face. She's breaking my heart already.
I'm sure Megan would not be 145 years old today, which is about how old Evelyn Nesbitt would be. She died in the 50s or 60s, I think.
Wow. It's astonishing how much she looks like Megan. God, I feel like this episode needs to be over.
When she got up to his apartment, girls were always delighted that he had a red velvet swing.
Oh, wow.
Which at first I'm sure he would use for innocent purposes.
Life goals.
He, White would always convince these girls' families that he was, had a fatherly interest in them.
Sure.
But unfortunately, the story does not end there. And I guess this should be a content warning for people who do not want any mentions of sexual assault, because the Evelyn Nesbitt story takes a dark turn.
Oh, no.
After convincing her family that he is, his intentions are purely noble, he lures her up to see the etchings, drugs her champagne, and rapes her.
Oh, no.
In a way that that would confuse many audiences, but which is not uncommon, she proceeds to continue to date him for a few years.
Right.
In which and he kind of introduces her to a newer and wealthier world, assuming presumably he's gaslighting her to some degree about the awful things he did to her and is continuing to do to other chorus girls. She soon realizes he's not going to leave his wife and that he's still messing around on his swing with every girl on Broadway. And she leaves him and takes up with Harry Thaw, an unstable steel millionaire's son from Philadelphia, who's never, kind of an idle rich kid who loves Evelyn, but is just obsessed with the idea of her with this gross old architect.
Right.
And it's just constantly wants details about their relationship.
A jealous and unstable scion of a steel millionaire. This is why we can't tax the rich.
Because if you do, they lose their ability to throw money at
chorus girls.
17-year-old chorus girls.
Right.
He takes her to Europe where, again, trigger warning number two, he comes to her room one night, rips off her nightgown and flogs her with some leather strap and rapes her. So she cannot catch a break with these awful men. Hmm. He's so obsessed that he even reverses the dental work that Stanford White paid for. He fixed some of her teeth, and Thaw has them put back.
Huh? How do you force someone to undergo dental work? Or did he say, I'm going to do even better? And then he whispered to the dentist, actually screw it up.
I bet she did what he said because he was a scary, commanding guy in an abusive relationship.
This is awful.
Although, you know, the dental side of it is something you don't normally see.
That is a little bit of an extreme version.
I guess the original rendezvous between White and Nesbitt must have been in the very late 1890s, because this story reaches its legal phase on the night of June 25th, 1906, when Thaw and Nesbitt are sitting at a show at Madison Square Garden. Thaw notices Stanford White, the designer of the building, sitting at a different table, so he walks over and shoots him twice in the face.
Whoa!
In the building that White himself had designed, murdering him in cold blood.
Whoa! Carrying a gun to the opera.
Taking a gun to the floor show and just shooting the guy in twice in the face. So you can see why it's the trial of the century.
Boy, I'll say.
Like a...
Hard to...
An eccentric millionaire shoots a... Today it would be like if Elon Musk walked into Hamilton and shot Frank Gehry, or you know, who's a famous architect, or some famous artist.
Pei.
Shoots I.M. Pei, 103-year-old I.M. Pei, in the face because they're fighting over some starlet, Selena Gomez or
right.
something. Like, it's got all the ingredients for weeks and weeks and months of headlines.
Hard to imagine that there would be much of a case for the defense.
The defense is interesting because this does not turn out to be one trial. It turns out to be three trials. And, of course, the fact that this stays in the headlines for months is where the device about the etching starts to simmer into the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. Oh, the thing, by the way, you'd think it would be a done deal. I think Thaw was prepared to go to jail because after he fires the three bullets, two into White's face and one into his shoulder, he says, get Mr. Andrew Carnegie and tell him that I've just done a murder or something. I don't know why he needs to bring the Carnegies into it.
I'll allow Carnegie.
We got in trouble when we said Carnegie last time.
Yeah, we did.
So I'm deferring to our hyper-correcting pedantic audience.
I cannot wait to see what the futurelings think about the Tijuana, or as you said, Tijuana.
I just started saying Tijuana.
Tijuana.
Which is correct.
But you didn't put the
Juana. You're going to start saying Marijuana.
I really am. Well, not start saying it. I've been saying it all along.
These turned out to be three trials. In the first trial, the lawyer wants to plead insanity, and Thaw will not have it. I knew exactly what I was doing.
That was a plea in 1906, the insanity.
Yes,
plea.
You could say this guy is nutty as a squirrel.
Was the scion of a steel, right. steel family.
This guy's inbred as hell, and he didn't know what he was doing. He went to all the best schools, but he's still crazy. But Thaw insisted that he was not crazy, so he got a new lawyer who built a case around the idea of the unwritten law that a man's woman is his property,
sure.
An execrable but popular idea of the time. And therefore, if anyone has messed with your property, vigilante justice is enough. Shooting him twice in the face at Madison Square Garden is not off the table.
I see. You demand some recourse.
And the law won't allow it, but the law will wink at it, I guess.
I see.
And this goes to trial with this defense. And the jury is deadlocked, 7-5. Seven jurors want to acquit.
Whoa.
They're persuaded by the unwritten law. So there's a mistrial. A second trial happens. This time a new counsel agrees, gets Thaw to agree to try an insanity plea. And this time it works, and he's committed to some booby hatch in, I think, Vermont or New Hampshire. He's sent up to New England. And he doesn't like it. I mean, he's been getting Delmonico's in prison. You know, he's
right.
He doesn't have it too bad.
It seems like an insane asylum would be an even easier place to sort of get yourself a suite built, and other members of your clan to bring you like sweet pies.
He does better than that with like files or rasps in them.
Well, no, here we are in our sequester. Like, if I were sequestered in my own private wing of a mental hospital and people were bringing me sweet pies, I don't know what else I would need.
He was not happy, apparently, and just walked out. It wasn't a high security facility.
I see.
He just walked by a confused guard and got across the border into Quebec, and suddenly an extradition trial begins.
Uh-huh.
So finally, there's a third trial. They get him back to New Hampshire, and he's tried again for insanity. And this time, he has found... I don't know how this works, but he's found...
Newly culpable?
No, newly sane and can leave the asylum, but also...
not guilty.
Not guilty on all charges of shooting a guy in the face twice.
Oh, so he went through... That's an elaborate,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, the long con.
You're not... you're not insane. Okay, you are insane. Now you're not insane, but he's, also not guilty.
He successfully forgot them to forget what it would mean if he was actually sane.
He forgot them to forget.
So he got off. And speaking of getting off, the idea of inviting women up to see your etchings became engraven in the popular consciousness mm-hmm. as a result of the trial of the century. And I think this was...
So it's like, it's basically like, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
I guess.
Like we took all this stuff from the OJ trial, the Bruno Magli shoes, the car chase. I mean, we still refer to those things.
Cato, Kalin, they're like our friends.
Right.
We...
Marcia Clark.
We love them all. We miss them.
James Ito.
I send Lance Ito. I send Christmas cards Ito. To Judge Ito every
I feel like I knew a James year. Ito.
By the 1930s, I think this is when the actual quote, come on up and I'll show you my etchings appears. And it appears of all places in print advertising for a Hollywood movie. In 1933, the movie The Warrior's Husband is released based on a Broadway hit. Katharine Hepburn starred on Broadway, but nobody as famous is in the movie. But it's a kind of a variation, a turnabout on the it's a use of the Amazon myth to turn about the typical gender play. It takes place in a fictional Greek-like Hellenistic state called Pontus, where the women are the amazing warriors.
Right.
And hilariously, the men are all kind of...
cucks.
Yeah. And again, using kind of the awful pansy stereotypes of the pre-code era, they're all kind of... ineffectual, limp-wristed house husbands.
Right.
And they're, in fact, played by drag artists from the BBB Cellar Review, a popular drag act in LA at the time, whose motto was Boys Will Be Girls. So there actually was authentic drag in this movie. But the point of the movie is that they need a real man, you know, a real Greek warrior comes in and, you know, this must have been popular at the time, because this is the Wonder Woman fantasy as well, that... that there's this island of powerful women that want to tie you up, but also if you're a dapper Air Force pilot, you can have your way with all of them.
Right.
So I guess before fetishes were
I do feel like it available. Is probably a fantasy that goes back quite a ways in time. It seems like something maybe baked in.
Maybe it is, but at the time there was no real outlet for it. So right. You kind of had to pretend you were into the Amazons of Greek mythology.
Right.
Maybe, in fact, maybe that's where the Amazon myth comes from.
That was what I was speculating. It is
even the ancient Greeks were like, what if there were these really strong women?
We have a lot of islands.
And what if they came to visit? And then...
they were good warriors, but we are great Air Force pilots.
So the print advertising for this movie included the line, come on up and I'll show you my etchings, which doesn't seem to have much to do with Amazons and their ineffectual husbands.
Is that the source of come on up and see me sometime, which was popular not that long after?
No, I think that's in She Done Him Wrong, a pretty early Mae West movie of about the same time.
Oh.
And so, you know, Alger would have been using etchings for this long before Mae West. So the idea predates come up and see me sometime is maybe a riff on it.
Yeah.
But without the actual etchings. And I think that's because by the 30s, as you can see in the Philip Marlowe references, the references to etching is becoming old hat. Like I found a 1938 advice column where it's kind of used as an example of a lame pickup line.
Right.
Kind of the way today we would make jokes about, you know, did it hurt when you fell from heaven? Or, you know, I told you you had a beautiful body, would you hold it against me? Or do you have a mirror in your pants? You know, all these things which are kind of...
Well, you seem to know a lot of these.
Oh, I got like 30 more here. Let's go through these. Like they're trotted out as examples of awful ways,
right?
Shop worn awful ways to try to pick up on a woman or man.
Something that that you might hear in Less Than Zero,
exactly. And so even by the 30s, the idea of showing someone your etchings was more of a punchline than an actual ploy.
It dated you.
It did. And the funny thing is it survived. Like as recently as New York, I found a New York Magazine article in 2006 where the headline is come up and look at my etchings. And it's about, kind of pied-à-terre penthouse seduction in the Wall Street age.
So has it come all the way around? Is it the new Netflix and chill? Come up and see my etchings?
Nothing has replaced Netflix and chill. And maybe it's because there's a new frankness around romance,
yeah,
such that you don't need a euphemism or maybe even a plausible deniability.
Oh, I think
if you're on the app, everyone knows why you're on the app.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose if you're on Tinder already, you don't need to invite people up to see your etchings. Although there is still a ton of euphemism because there are a lot of people on Tinder that claim that they're just in it for the cuddles. Hey, I'm not into anything serious. I don't want to have sex. I just want cuddles. Come up and see my etchings.
Yeah, even cuddles is a euphemism sometime,
well,
which I don't like.
Sure, I would never say cuddles. Even if we were cuddling, I wouldn't use the term cuddles.
You and I have cuddled many times, and you have never used the word cuddles.
No.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely not. I do it out of respect. And that concludes Etchings, entry 428.GN3907. Certificate number 2793 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media has survived this latest plague, you know, social media is in and of itself a plague, which do you think would survive if they had to share a petri dish? If you put social media and COVID-19 together in one petri dish.
We can try this out today. Just take Mark Zuckerberg and put him in a room with a bunch of coronavirus.
See who survives.
See what happens. It's definitely going to be coronavirus. In the first round, it'll be coronavirus.
In the unlikely event, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. And our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. I am still kind of lurking on Twitter under duress. Ken is there spreading the disease of his sense of humor.
I'm making it good for you. Like, I'm the best thing about Twitter right now for
you.
It's
true. You and Jason Isbell.
He's pretty good.
I'm also on Instagram at John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Our fan groups are The Futurelings on Facebook and Reddit and Discord and other places. Just put Futurelings in. I think we're currently the only people using Futurelings.
Is that good or does it make us seem ineffectual because we haven't been able to get it to catch on?
No, I think it's catching on. I just think that if you find the word Futureling anywhere in the world, it's going to refer to the Omnibus Project and not some other weird cult of juggalos and post office aficionados.
Some kind of weird Tawana Bible where all the aliens have tentacles.
You can email us your comments and complaints or your dad's old sunglasses to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
I'm not sure who sent us this, but somebody sent us an antiqued parchment, so it actually looks like a period document, although it is not, of the Monroe Doctrine. You know how a certain kind of person is always carrying the Constitution around with them? Have you ever wanted to carry the Monroe Doctrine around with you?
Here's the weird thing. That was not sent to us. Oh. You just opened an envelope containing the Monroe Doctrine that I actually bought.
Where did you buy the Monroe Doctrine?
I bought it at the Fort Lewis Army Museum. I was like, you have a weird parchmented copy of the Monroe Doctrine? I want it now.
Well, you were just in the Caribbean. You could have brought this with you to Latin America and used it to get all kinds of free perks.
I could.
Haven't you guys heard?
I could have waved it around.
This is my hemisphere.
and also, we do not want to seem tone deaf to the decay of our time and the economic collapse and also the many struggles that maybe our presentlings are facing.
We hope that the 100% free Omnibus twice a week is a salve to you in troubled times.
And we will continue to create content so that in your sequestered garrets, you're not reduced to only looking at etchings, but we'll continue to have our mellifluous content.
Imagine using podcasting as a sexual...
hey, come on up and listen to Ken Jennings and John Roderick.
You want to come up and listen to the McElroys?
a thing less sexy I cannot think of... But you can contribute to the production of our show at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We don't think the current plague is the final thing. In fact, we hope, or the recession that will inevitably follow the global plague. We don't think that's the final thing either, because we're resilient people. But at some point, there's going to be something where resilience just doesn't cut it. Rising sea levels, doesn't matter how resilient you are, unless you have an aqua lung. We hope and pray that such a catastrophe may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.